Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi everybody, I hope you enjoyed my new Wild Wild podcast theme remix there. I tried to make it sound a bit like Batman from the 60s. Because we are back, it's a new year, it's a new season, which is quite good timing, that's mainly coincidental. Anyway, so welcome to Wild Wild Podcast. I am Adrian Smith and I am joined by my incredibly busy co-host, Rodney Barnett. Hello, Rod.
Hello, Adrian. How are you doing today?
Yeah, well, exciting times. There seem to be projects left, right, and centre for both of us. Do you have anything that you quickly want to mention that is out soon or out now?
Oh my! Well, the only thing that's out imminently is the track that Troy, Gwen, and I did together for Mono Macabro's release of Dr. Jekyll and the Wolfman, which is about to ship to the people who pre-ordered it the end of last year, any day now. So that's going to start arriving in people's mailboxes soon. And then soon thereafter, the standard edition will be available to those who did not get the early limited edition. So that's coming out. We did a commentary on that film, which is one of the extremely fun and very entertaining Valdemar Daninsky films that Nashi made. So that's the thing that's imminent, and it's really the only thing at this point that I can talk about openly.
So yes, we have to, all this secrecy. I don't know, maybe since I can't remember when it arrived or when we did our last episode, but obviously our Danza Macabre volume 2 contribution, that is out now. I think that probably arrived in the post for people since our last episode, so hopefully some of you have had the chance to watch Castle of Blood or Danza Macabre. Both versions are available on there, and I think our commentary is on the Danza Macabre version, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't actually watched it to check.
I haven't watched the UHD because I don't have the ability, but I did check our track on the Blu-ray, and I managed to listen to us talk without cringing too much, because I can't do that. I hear my voice on a silvery disc and I do freak out a little bit.
So. But it worked, right? We were there.
We were definitely there.
Okay, good. Yeah, so it was very exciting. Also, since then, I've had the opportunity to make to record a video interview for the next in the Forgotten Jolly box sets from Vinegar Syndrome. So they are doing, include one of the films included in the volume 6 is Antonio Margheriti's Naked You Die. And as everyone knows, of course, we are big Margheriti fans here on this podcast and on all the podcasts that, that we've done over the years, I'm sure. But a few years ago, I tracked down the British actress who is in Naked You Die, and it turns out that she lives not far away from me, and I've become quite good friends with her over the last few years. And so when I found out that they were doing Naked You Die, I immediately jumped at the chance to get an interview with her on the disc, because she's told me great stories about making that film, and I really wanted her to be part of that. So managed to put it together very short notice, like a week before Christmas. So that is going to be on there, and I'm really pleased about that. So yeah, my friend Sally Smith is on that disc telling her stories of visiting Italy in the late 60s and shooting Naked You Die. So I'm very pleased that everyone else is going to get to hear her fun stories on that one. And of course, you and I are now involved in another secret commentary project. So
yes.
So for that reason, we're doing this episode now, but then my hopes of getting another episode out relatively quickly are somewhat scuppered, because we need to spend the next couple of weeks working on that. So maybe we'll get to do another the next episode of this podcast by the end of January, but don't hold your breath is what I'm saying. So
there's a lot going on, folks.
Yeah, we're starting the season now, but then you may have to wait a little while for the next one, which of course does mean that you've got some time there to do your homework and maybe watch some of the films that we have coming up. So I thought, so we're doing this season, I don't know if I've said what it is, this is a fumetti or sort of comic book superhero season. This is one that I've wanted to do ever since we started the podcast, so I'm excited that we're finally here. So let me tell you all what films we have in the pipeline. I should have got this prepared.
I've got it here in front of us. We're going to start with Criminal today.
Yes, Criminal. Exciting. Okay, and then?
Super Argo and the Faceless Men, or Super Argo versus Diabolicus, yeah. 1966 as well.
Yeah, because there's two Super Argo films, and if we've got time, we'll try them, try and cover them both, but we'll see how that goes. yes, and then that's followed by Argo Man, the Fantastic Superman, which is a really fun one.
The Three Fantastic Supermen from 1967, one that I think I have seen. I'm not looking forward to revisiting, but we'll see what, see what that's like.
Yeah, is it Alfonso Breccia, that one? I can't remember.
I'll be honest, I haven't gone back to look, but yeah. I do fear that is true, yes.
I know we've got at least one of his coming up, which will be something to look forward to. And then we are dipping back into the Ruggiero Deodato well with Phenomenal and the Treasure of Tutankhamun.
I'm looking forward to that one.
That's going to be fun.
Then 1968's Avenger X, also known as Mr. X, which I saw years ago, but I can't remember much about it, so that's going to be interesting to revisit.
Yeah, and then I ummed and ahed about whether we should include Danger Diabolic or not, because it's the film that, you know, if anyone has seen one of these, it's that one.
True.
But then I thought, why deny ourselves of the opportunity of maybe picking up some new listeners who are searching for a podcast about Diabolic? So, and also it would kind of be crazy not to do what is obviously the best one.
True, I guess so.
So yeah, Danger Diabolic is coming in the middle, and then
Satanic from 1968, one that I think I saw years ago, but I have no memory of. So that'll be interesting to revisit.
Yeah, that's a female masked villain. That one should be fun. And I believe the comic, Satanic, the comic, was written by the same people who wrote Criminal. So
yes.
We're all sort of full circle already. Yeah, and then we're going to check out Bruno Corbucci's Miss Stiletto, which is based on the comic Isabella Duchessa de Diavoli, or Isabella Duchess of the Devil. I guess that's what it says.
Yeah. I recently saw that for the first time just last year and actually really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. And then we do get to, I'm afraid, very, very afraid.
We're going to end on a damp squib, yes.
Like, it's like our space season again.
Super Stooges versus the Wonder Women from 1974, which I know I've seen part of. I don't know that I was ever able to work up the gumption to finish it.
I know, and I know that, like, because unlike a couple of previous seasons, like the space season, basically we just did the only 10 films that existed in that particular genre. Now, there are more masked villain, masked hero, superhero films than this. And so I kind of ummed and ahed about which ones to put in. But I thought, because mainly it's the 60s, sort of mid to late 60s. But I just thought it would be interesting to see what was happening just a few years later as the last gasps of the genre. So, yeah, that's why we're doing that one, I guess. Which is Alfonso Breccia. So apologies in advance for that one. And then, so that's our main run. If we've got time, I'd like to fit in the new Diabolik film, because in Italy right now there is a new Diabolik trilogy. The third film is coming out sometime this year. I think they just had the premiere recently, so it's out pretty soon. So they're sort of doing Diabolik again, so it'd be fun to check that out at the end if we've got time. But anyway, there you go. So most, if not all, well, I mean, obviously I've picked these because they're all available. Some are available on DVD. There's a couple on Blu-ray. And others you'll just have to track down various murky non-legal sources to find them. But they're all out there in various forms. Again, it's another genre where it would... I just sort of don't understand quite why no one's done a restoration and a box set of some of these. It would be sort of crying out to be stuck out together in a big box.
Well, I mean, I guess this will join the other little weird genres of this kind of exploitation film from Europe that I'll add this to the list of genres that I just keep calling for people to start paying attention to and start putting out, because I think there would be more interest as soon as people knew they were available. And you know, this along with like the rapiers and ruffles stuff, you know, the adventure stuff that doesn't fit into the big muscle man stuff that was being produced in the 60s in Italy in droves as well. That would be fun. And the Fumetti stuff would be a great, you know, there are several box sets that I can imagine being produced. As to whether they would sell or not, I would, you know, I would hope it would be a kind of, you know, if you build it, they will come situation, but you know, who knows?
I mean, Rapiers and Ruffles, that's the perfect title for our next season. I think that's, we've got that right there.
I was when I was writing a piece on some of the films that Umberto Lenzi made in the early 60s, I was struggling to find some kind of catch-all phrase for that particular kind of genre, and I just rattled that one off and was like, well, that's as close as anything I can find, so I'll just go ahead and use that as a phrase for them. So, you know, there you go.
Well, let's do it. But yeah, I've got the sneaking suspicion, Rod, that the Blu-ray company that you and I have theoretically set up is going to go bust pretty quickly. But
yes, probably.
But at least we would have copies if no one else.
Yes, yes. All of that work and all of that bankruptcy would be worth it.
So let's get to our first film, Criminal. This was really one of the first film adaptations of the Italian comic. So in the first comic of this sort was Diabolik in 1962. And Max Bunker and Magnus. Max Bunker was the writer, Magnus was the artist. Max Bunker was only 25, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And they decided to make a character that was like Diabolik, only even worse a person. So Criminal, he's got no morals at all. He is basically he kills women and men. He will seduce women and then kill them if it serves his purposes. And
he's
there's
a
kind
sociopath
of
or a psychopath, or perhaps a fictional blending of the two. There are qualities about Diabolik to admire. That, you know, you can. I mean, he sometimes acts as a bit of a Robin Hood character, but Criminal's just a scumbag.
And oh yeah,
you're just following his exploits for the sheer jolly joy of it. So.
And they were known as fumetti neri, or basically black comics that were for adults only, mm-hmm. because the artwork was quite explicit.
And obviously
the characters are quite sadistic. And the success of Criminal inspired loads more. There are tons of these things, including there's a character called Sadistic, who because they also had these things called Photoromanza, which is basically photo comics. So there's a whole series of sadistic comics where you've got this guy in the skeleton costume beating up people and killing women and doing all kinds of sadistic violent stuff, but these were photos, and they were also considered to be quite shocking. And after a couple of years, people, a bit like the sort of horror comic saga in America and also over here, once I think people started to realize what was going on in these comics, there were cries for things to be toned down. And I think after a couple of years, Criminal did actually get a wife as a way of trying to tone down the sort of sexual violence of the comics.
Which the first time I saw this film, I wasn't expecting there to be a kind of ex-wife character in the film. Yeah. I just assumed he was such a psychopath and a loner that he would keep himself free of any entanglements that might slow him down. But
although he throws her under a bus pretty quick.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, and in a film that played with a harder edge, that might have really kind of been a nice sting. But
so that's a good point. So Umberto Lenzi, he felt the comics were too violent. Although things I've read, I've been reading Troy Howarth's book, and also Roberto Curti wrote a book about these films.
Mm-hmm.
And the suggestion is that he'd never really read any of the comics. So maybe he just picked up on the reputation the comics had for violence and so on. So he wanted to tone it down. Which is funny, because when Mario Bava came to make Diabolik, he wanted to sort of ramp that stuff up. But yes, you can imagine if the film Criminal had been made by somebody who had a much more adult-oriented focus, that could have been much more violent, much more sexy, potentially more interesting than it kind of ended up. It's basically been turned into a Eurospy film by Umberto Lenzi. But the script originally, the comic writer, Max Bunker, he wanted to write the script. But because Umberto Lenzi wanted a sort of safer film, he turned it down. So it's sort of a shame, because you can imagine. So Umberto Lenzi wrote the script, but he never really read that many of the comics by all accounts. So it could have been a very different film.
And I think I always end up, I've seen this film before. This will be my second or third time seeing it, but the first time I saw it was a long time back. And every time I come away from a viewing of Criminal with the idea that this probably should have been a bit more adult. There should have been a bit more of an edge to the character. But I mean, I enjoy what's there. I really do. But I do get a sense that this is a character straining at the leash, and really would have been more interesting if given a bit more play into the fields of the nastiness that the comic always had.
Yeah. So there's a backstory which we don't get in the film, because we just come into it's like we sort of pick up in the middle of Criminal's adventures. So apparently he was a former circus acrobat who was abandoned by his father and then grew up in an orphanage followed by a reform school. So that's why he turned into a cold-blooded murderer. As you would. So the costume is a sort of hangover from growing up in the circus. But if he was an acrobat, we don't We don't see much of that in the film.
There's a little bit of it. There's some interesting stuff with him, leaping off of roofs onto different places, and there's a little bit of the acrobatics. But yeah, I would have expected a little bit more, especially since you can essentially just put an acrobat in that outfit and film it from a distance and have crazy stuff happen. And
yeah, in the sequel, which we'll talk about a little bit, The Mark of Criminal. There is a sequence where he climbs up the front of a house.
Which is pretty nice, yeah.
And then jumps down from a quite high balcony all in one shot, which was quite impressive. But again, like you said, because it's a bit like the sort of Spider-Man thing, you can have anyone in that costume doing the stunts. Although, in this film, there is a sequence where he has to run across... He climbs up onto the roof of a train in that classic style that every film does and runs along the top of the train. And that is actually our hero, Glenn Saxon, doing that without the mask on, which I was really impressed with, actually. I was like, wow, that's really the actor running along the top of the train. Tom Cruise, eat your heart out. And apparently that's because his stunt double had been injured, so he wasn't available, so he just did it himself. It reminded me of, have you ever seen the first Great Train Robbery?
With Sean the Connery. One directed by Michael Crichton with Sean Connery up on top of the train.
Yeah,
that was really Connery.
That's amazing. Yeah, I could not believe what I was watching. That's amazing that he's really on the train and he's jumping down to miss the bridges and all of that. It's pretty amazing. But anyway, so there could have been more of the acrobatic stuff, but it does, I suppose, explain a little bit his tendency towards wanting to wear a full skeleton costume, because otherwise we don't really, the film doesn't give us anything. It doesn't give us any backstory or particular motivation for the costume. In the second film, there's a couple of times where people see him and think he's a ghost, so that sort of makes sense then, that maybe he's wearing this costume to inspire fear and make people think that he's a ghost.
And that's something that they could have played up more. I mean, when they, especially in the second film, you're right, that is something that gets played around with, because people will see him at a distance, and the nature of his costume, when they're seeing him at night, the nature of his costume does make it look kind of creepy, and so you can see how that could maybe spook somebody. But they don't do a lot with that at all, and they don't do anything with it in this film. It's essentially just for lack of a better term, just a disguise.
Yeah. And so let's, before we get into the plot then, let's just talk very, with Umberto Lenzi, what more can we say? We've talked about him many times. If you want to hear us talk about Umberto Lenzi, go back and check out some of our Poliziotteschi episodes. Our star here is Glenn Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
The weirdest spelling of Saxon, Saxon, which I think was that's not his real name anyway.
No, it's not. He's actually a Dutch actor. His real name, and I'm going to probably mess this up, is... Well, his real name's Roel Bos? Or Bos?
Yeah, why not?
I cannot speak that language, so who knows how a proper name in that language is spoken.
And we've spoken about him before briefly, because he was in Luana.
Yes, exactly.
And Luana was shot just after, like not long after Criminal. But he's also obviously got some experience. He came to Italy and immediately started popping up in sort of westerns. He's played Django once or twice, I think, or maybe just once. Did a few westerns, and then, Luana and Criminal. And then he ended up going off to Germany to do some sex comedies, which...
Yeah, I was not aware that his 70s films... went into the direction of School of Erotic Enjoyment and things of that nature. But hey.
Well, I mean, who wouldn't?
I suppose. Well, yeah, if offered the cash.
But one of the other stars we should talk about this film, somebody who I know you are very familiar with, is Helga Linné.
Oh my, yes. I have spent an hour, I guess the word would be researching. I'm gonna use that word. researching
Linnae's and
career,
and rhapsodizing about her on your other podcast. But in case anybody listening hasn't heard you talk about her on the NeshaCast or the Bloody Pit, can you just give us a kind of brief summary of your feelings? I mean, about Helga Linné.
Helga Linnae has always been, since my first encounter with her, which probably would have been in Horror Rises from the Tomb, she's always been one of those incredibly gorgeous women who worked in European exploitation, who not only is just stunningly attractive and apparently from the moment that I first saw her, more than willing to be naked on screen, but also very effective as an actress. In other words, she's not just there because she's a beautiful face. I have really enjoyed being able to track her career. She was a dancer and an acrobat in her childhood. Her first movie appearance was apparently at the age of 10. So by the time you get into the 60s, she's been in movies with larger and larger parts. Of course, her early appearances in film were bit roles and, you know, things without dialogue. And then she moved fully into a long-term career there. And she is always good, and no matter what role you see her in. But it is wild, having started with her appearance in Horror Rises from the Tomb, which was made at the time she was 40, to go back and look at her in her 20s and 30s and realize that this woman was incredibly talented. She obviously trained hard and well to become a screen actress, and she's very good. She's fantastic here in where she gets to play two of herself.
Twins.
And she's always a bright spot in any film you run across, and she's still with us today, thank goodness, and has talked at length in many interviews, thank goodness, also about her career and talked openly about what she enjoyed and what she didn't, and those interviews are highly entertaining if you run across them. She's outspoken in what she likes and what she doesn't like, and she, well, I guess at this point she's of course reached the point where it doesn't matter. She says about anyone, her career is made, she's amazing, and I did think it amazing to find that she also pops up in the sequel playing a completely different character.
Yes, that confused me, I have to admit.
I think that it's one of those situations where the first film was a success. And they may have just wanted to bring along as much of the cast. You know, they were able to bring along three of the cast. Yeah. And it would have been impossible to really kind of logically include the previous character she played. So they'll just invent another character for her.
In my head, they weren't twins. They were triplets.
Well, then you might want to tell the people who wrote the dialogue in the film, because she's never referenced as having anything to do with the others.
This is the estranged sister who had nothing to do with the other two.
But I'll just recommend that. Well, if you're a fan of Spanish horror at all, you will have run across Helga Linnae in everything from Horror Express to The Lorelei's Grasp, The Vampire's Night Orgy. She was even in a Santo film, Santo versus Dr. Death, one of my all-time favorite El Santo films. And my goodness, you will not go wrong. She was in a couple of movies with Paul Naschy, including The Mummy's Revenge. She pops up in The Killer of Dolls in a very difficult role, but also she's excellent in that as well.
Yeah.
Helga Linnae is, you can follow her career and really have a good time. You might even want to dip into a film she made called Black Candles that came out in 1982. That one's available on Blu-ray as well, here in the States at least.
Oh, you did the commentary for that, didn't you?
Yeah, Troy and I did a commentary for that film as well. And,
isn't there something to do with goats?
There's a... Yes, in Black Candles there is a bestiality scene. It is, we're pretty sure, faked. But it has nothing to do with Helga Linnae, folks. So don't let that dissuade you.
I'm just getting flashbacks now to... I just recently watched The Antichrist, because that's just come out on Blu-ray. And there's a quite pleasant visual image conjured up that's between the main woman and a goat in that film. Sorry, I'm just suddenly... That's all I can see now. But anyway, so yeah, sidetracked. Yeah, so Helga Linnae, she did something like 150 films. She had a really successful career.
Oh yeah, lots of televisions, lots of Spanish television in the early 2000s, and yeah, she has had an amazing career, and she is very talented.
Yeah, and she's German, right? I think originally.
Well, she was born in Germany, but the vast majority of her career did circle around Spain and Italy. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So that was fun to see her and her twin appear in this film. I don't know if there's anyone else particularly is there anyone else in the cast that you wanted to mention? I'm pretty much unfamiliar with all of them apart from the main two.
I do think it's I do really enjoy the actor who plays the inspector.
Inspector Milton.
I think he's great. He's I have not seen him in a lot of other movies. He's very good in both of these criminal films. He passed away in 2012, but had a pretty steady career up until the mid 80s when he stopped doing this. I ran across him in Lucio Fulci's Manhattan Baby, which is the place that most stood out for me as something that I recognized him from. And he was in a few spaghetti westerns across the 60s, which is a big shock. And he also, and this will, you know, it just for giggles, he does play a bank manager in Danger Diabolic.
Yeah, of course.
I should say his name, Andrea Bozic. He was a Yugoslavian actor. And he had worked with Lindsay before in Sandokan the Great. And that the casting may have been because that because of that association, he worked with him on a couple of films before this one. So
he was in Ricardo Freire's Machiste el Inferno, which, for the benefit of you, because I don't know if you can see me on the camera, I have a poster for that on the wall just over my shoulder.
I don't know if you
can see that. So that's quite fun. That's a good one actually. Machiste el Inferno is really good. Machiste goes to hell. Yes, we will also see man Andrea here. We'll see him again. He's in Argo Man. So, he'll pop up again in there. Yeah, okay, yes, good point. Because he's in both films, actually playing the same character. It's basically a very similar dynamic that Diabolik has with the police. It's worth mentioning, actually. I think there was this sense in Italy that bad things couldn't happen, so Diabolik is set basically in France.
I hadn't thought about that.
And Criminal is set in England, where supposedly he's being dogged by Scotland Yard.
He does travel to the continent after the beginning of the film.
But even, like, the houses that he's at, which are supposed to be still in England, are obviously in Italy.
They are much more Italian in their layout, especially those spacious backyards.
Yeah, there's a house they go to that's called Villa de something. Like, the name of it is Italian, and they give that a big close-up, even though they're supposedly in London. The geography as well at the beginning of this film of London is hilariously wrong.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I've always felt that the geography of Danger Diabolik is similarly odd in that they're keeping it as vague as possible as to which country you're in, and even when they're being specific, it's like, I don't know if that's what that looks like.
Yeah, Diabolik is quite vague, but it's kind of all French. But this one specifically says it's in London, which is pretty funny. There's a sequence where he runs from... Well, and no, I'll get to that when we talk about the plot. But yeah, the geography of London is all over the place.
And of course, we know we're in London because the first thing we see in the film is London Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I was just there yesterday by total coincidence. Right, shall we have a go at the plot?
Let's do it.
There's a couple of things that I wanted to mention... Yeah, this beginning. So I'm using the plot summary from Roberto Curti's book. The ruthless thief and cold-blooded murderer known as Criminal escapes from a London prison just a few moments before he is to be hanged. Now, we should mention here that there is a good reason why he escaped. Well, he's being hanged because he stole the crown jewels. And I was trying to work out why that would be a hanging offence. And I suppose maybe because it's treason. That's the only thing I could think of.
I think it's probably a hanging offense, because that is the most cinematic way in which to watch this character die.
Treason may have still been a capital, because we still had capital punishment in the UK up until about 1969, but it was generally only for murderers. But maybe treason would have counted. So, but he escapes because Milton, who I'm sure regretted it moments later, had actually arranged for him to escape. He's helped him to escape because he's hoping that he will lead him back to the crown jewels, because they still haven't found them. Basically, Criminal will not tell them where they are. Mm-hmm. So he figures the only way he's going to get them back is by helping Criminal escape. And so they've got this whole sequence of Criminal escaping out of London and then running through London, and the police are following him and watching him. And there's a really and they had some they clearly had some money making this movie, because they're on location. They're actually in London, and it's not second unit, it's the whole gang. Because we see Criminal cross the road in front of Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to the police, who are parked down some side street, which I just want to say is nowhere near Buckingham Palace. And they say, yes, he's now heading, he's just passing the docks and heading west.
It's like, and, Adrian, stop destroying the reality of the film for me. Stop.
Like, if you're passing the docks... The docks are nowhere near Buckingham Palace. The docks are in the east.
Or miles away, yes.
Yeah, they're in the east, miles away, and the west end is kind of where Buckingham Palace is. So I don't know where he's going. But also, did you notice Umberto Lenzi has a cameo here? He plays one of the... Umberto Lenzi is one of the cops. He's standing, leaning against a wall, reading a newspaper.
Oh, my goodness, I did not know that.
Yeah, wearing sunglasses. That's Umberto Lenzi. So he gets a line as one of the cops who's watching... Criminal. So they're following him to try and find out where the crown jewels are. But then basically they lose him, and he sends the crown jewels back as a present to Milton anyway, because he can't get rid of them. They're too hot. So the whole thing was basically pointless.
The whole thing was a great big circle of nothing, just for entertainment value, apparently. Yeah. And in the context of the film, it would be just entertainment value for a Criminal. He's just doing this to have a laugh to a degree. But it almost got him killed. I mean, let's...
I know. Yeah. hounded by Scotland Yard's Inspector Milton, Criminal is sheltered by his ex-wife Margie, who is currently the secretary of Lady Gold, the owner of an import-export jewellery firm. Mm-hmm. So some nice nominative determinism going on there. Criminal learns that a large amount of diamonds will be shipped to Turkey the next day.
And you just know that's going to play into things.
Now, there's a lot of... Yeah, so he sets up a plan to steal them at the airport. So this is where we discover that Lady Gold's amazing security plan is to have hire a pair of twins, one of whom will be carrying the diamonds in a briefcase, and the other one will be carrying...
Nothing.
Just an empty briefcase, right? That's kind of the... and these twins are, of course, played by Helga Linnaeus. So Criminal is going to intervene at the airport. I don't think he realises until he gets to the airport and sees the two women. I think he thinks there's only one or something. Mm-hmm. So he's not fully in on the plan. And then, so he follows the wrong sister, and he's got this magic cigarette, which if he blows it in someone's face, they pass out. And I was wondering whether that was some kind of drugs reference.
I honestly, it just seems to be a special, like a James Bond-like gadget to be able to knock someone out in public without drawing attention to yourself.
So he steals the bag, but it's empty. And that twin is then out of the movie. We never hear of her again. And he heads off to Istanbul to follow the other twin. But meanwhile, he discovers that Lady Gold has claimed that the diamonds were stolen. Mm-hmm. So she's like ripping off the insurance company, and he then decides that she must have set him up. Is that right? I'm already, even though I'm reading a plot summary here, I'm finding that this plot is slipping through my fingers like sand.
But it's clear that since the diamonds actually have not been stolen, it seems that either she's scamming the insurance company, or she's reporting it this way in advance of knowing which one of the two couriers was actually knocked unconscious and had her bag stolen at the airport. So the film does lay it all out for us eventually, but the fact that it's big news that quick does point toward her kind of aiming to collect the insurance money.
So basically then we start to realize that maybe Inga, who is the twin, I think, that does make it to Istanbul, is in on this as well. And she has some, there's a guy whose name is, there's a guy who's sort of her lover.
Yeah, who she's already, she's already struck some kind of deal with to make off with the diamonds and themselves.
Yeah, and he's a dealer at a casino. I've forgotten his name. Because it's not on the IMDb.
I'm not sure what his name was either. Maybe we should just soldier on.
Anyway, if it's not on the IMDb, it doesn't exist. but so basically, without just describing the rest of the plot, so he's now trying to get the diamonds and trying to sort of cross and double cross. And there's a lot of reliance. His plans often seem to rely on some pretty thin possibilities of stuff actually happening, or on coincidence. There's one bit in particular. So this guy who is from the casino, who's sort of in cahoots with Inga, he breaks into his house dressed in the costume and hides, and puts this he replaces his can of shaving foam. And then the next morning this guy goes to shave. Now, I don't know about you, Rod, but I haven't, like, I've been using an electric razor since the late 90s, so it's been a long time since I've used shaving foam. But you don't normally spray the shaving foam directly onto your face from the can, do you?
No, I do tend to put it into my hand, work it into a lather, and then apply it to my face, yes.
So this guy just sprays it straight into his face, but of course it's acid. And I just thought, maybe Criminal's been spying on this guy to make note of his habits, and then thought, this guy's really weird. He sprays the stuff straight
onto his face. That's dangerous.
I wonder if I can do something with that. Because otherwise his plan was originally to just burn this guy's hand. Right? Like, what's he going to do?
But that wouldn't have worked, because the entire plan that he has set up is to have him with his face and head wrapped in bandages.
So. Yeah, so then he can take his place. So I just thought, there's a lot of kind of what-ifs involved there. But that seemed quite funny to me. There's a few places, especially in the next film as well.
Where Adrian, I'm going to need you to stop thinking so hard about these bizarre, elaborate, insane, completely impossible plots and just let it wash over you as the psychotic thing that it is.
Yeah, it's funny.
You're not entering into the spirit of it, Adrian.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Also, we should mention there are occasional comic book panels that pop up on the screen.
Yes, which I found very entertaining.
Yeah, which is quite fun. I don't know whether it was budgetary, but it seems to be mainly, or especially in the second film, they want us to see what Criminal or other characters are thinking. So it cuts to a kind of comic panel, and then we get a speech bubble of what they're thinking. In this film,
invariably in Italian, which of course hampered my understanding a bit.
That's true, because the subtitles didn't always translate the speech bubbles. In this movie, the whole ending of the film is done in comic book panels, which makes me wonder whether they just ran out of time and didn't film it.
I don't know. I think that I have a theory about that, and it's based on absolutely nothing. We get to the end of the film, and the film wraps itself up in a nice, tight little way, and then we have comic book panels. Kind of kick the door back open on the possibilities of more adventures for our main character.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if that was done that way, if that was the original intent, or if that was an idea of, hey, we might want to do more of these, so let's kind of, make sure we have a way to, hinge our way from this film into a second film. by intimating that this wasn't really him getting caught yet again. Although I don't understand, they start this movie with him captured and about to be hanged. So why wouldn't they have just thought, well, we'll just start the second film that way too, and just have him, you know, manage to escape in a different way at the beginning of the second movie? But I don't know.
Well, what it appears to be at the end, so it looks like he's been captured. By a character who we'd all forgotten about, who then suddenly turns up again at the end and turns out to have been working with the police.
Yeah, and I was really happy with that. That was a nice little turn there, because, you know, the character in particular is just memorable enough for you to go, oh yeah, she's, wow, that's weird, she's back in the film, and then it's like, very nice.
But then, so he looks like he's captured, he escapes, but then the police are there and they capture him. Mm-hmm. Because at the beginning of the next film, the police believe that he's still in jail in Istanbul, but somehow he's managed to escape and got someone else to take his place. Although that's never explained exactly how he persuaded someone else to take his place in prison.
Yes, it is.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Later in the film, apparently the guy who took his place in jail... wait a minute, am I crossing this up with another film? Wasn't this someone who was going to be dying anyway? Nope, this has to be something.
That's another movie.
But no, that's got to be a different movie.
This is something that's happened in other films.
Oh my goodness, I'm seeing too many films all at once. This is crazy.
Doesn't this also happen in... it's in one of the Fu Manchu films.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the first of the Christopher Lee Fu Manchu films starts with Fu Manchu having his head cut off in an execution. Yeah. I mean, that's the opening sequence of the film, and you're just like, well, that's interesting. Is the rest of it in flashback? And it's just like, no, he's just wrangled someone to be plastic surgeoned into place. Yeah.
But, the second film picks up pretty much where it left off. And again, also manages to do quite a lot of international travel, which is quite impressive. We're in Istanbul again. It's very Eurospy.
Films. We should point out that. And this is, you know, this is kind of the obvious thing staring at us from across the room. The fact that these various comic books, Diabolik and Criminal, the comic books, the Fumetti, preceded the James Bond film series by a couple of years. But by the time these movies are being made, the James Bond films have started. A couple or three of them have already been produced and are on the big screen and are gigantic worldwide hits. So the Bond films are a real influence on how these things are being brought to the big screen. So what you're seeing here is kind of the darkness of those Fumetti comics, those adult comics produced in Italy, being put through the cinematic sensibilities of the James Bond series. And they're being, you know, a bit of a payoff financially. Obviously, they did make two of these films, these Criminal films. But at the same time, the cross pollination between these two types of things they tend to, in my opinion, when looking back anyway, they seem to have kind of watered down what could have been a really particularly nasty thing. I do think that Danger Diabolik escapes. You know, being made in 68, where maybe there luckily have been a bit more time to pass to realize that maybe the Eurospy thing wasn't going to be the thing that lasts us for 20 years. And so I think that, well, that and having Bava at the helm is a whole different can of worms of creative genius. But at this film and a few of the others are going to feel like they're still hangovers and part of the Euro spy genre to a large degree.
Yeah. And they didn't all get... I think there was hope with this film that it would get international distribution, but as far as I can tell, it didn't really.
Yeah, it did not. At all. And that's why there... I mean, as far as I can tell, there was never an English dub of it at all.
No.
So anytime you're watching it, you're going to have to be... Well, for English speakers anyway, you're going to have to be watching a subtitled version. I was a little surprised that it didn't get an English dub.
Because I think perhaps to a degree he was, you know, they're trying to go with the success of Batman, and you'd think that might have been reciprocated and American audiences might have responded to some of these films because of the connections to the sort of similarity to the Batman films. But
yeah.
No, evidently not. But they did manage a sequel. So 2 years later, we've got The Mark of Criminal, 1968, which is not directed by Umberto Lenzi, but Glenn Saxon is back, and as we said, Helga Lange is back as the third sister, or not.
And Inspector Milton is back as well.
And Inspector Milton is back, who's getting married, which is quite fun. He's supposed to be getting married, but Criminal kind of ruins his wedding. The plot is based around, I think it's basically based on the Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Six Napoleons, which is the one
Where you may be right there. I had not really thought about that, but
where there's somebody going around breaking into people's houses and smashing Napoleon statues, but then it turns out that they're looking for something that's hidden inside one of them. And I thought it might be based on that, I don't know, but because in this one, Criminal, again, there's a lot of sort of reliance on coincidence. He happens to break a statue.
I was about to say, the entire thing that with these statues, the whole start of Criminal's interest in this is purely accidental.
So him and his girlfriend are running this business where they basically take out insurance claims on old women and then kill them. And then one of the women they've killed, and also he run the funeral home where the funerals are held at the women, but then I don't know.
He seems to be running the old folks' home where these people live.
Yeah, and mysteriously die. And one of them had a statue, this green Buddha, and he accidentally smashes it, and they discover a piece of map in it. And luckily for him, there is a letter on the back explaining what to do with all these pieces of map, which is very helpful. I mean, imagine
because otherwise there would be no film.
Yeah, because imagine if he'd got one of the other ones and it was just a random piece of map. He'd have no idea what to do with it. So, that then launches him to go and find the other pieces of map, because it's leading to, it's basically Indiana Jones, this story. It's sort of leading to finding a stolen Goya and another, was it a Rembrandt, something like that.
Yeah, two paintings that's the treasure that they're after.
Yeah, that are hidden in a tomb in I want to say Beirut. Was it Beirut?
I believe so. I know that's definitely one of the shooting locations. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're going to go. So they've got to find the pieces to put the map together to go and find these paintings. We get back. We see Criminal getting back to his old ways. I thought this was maybe a comment on the comics, because since the first Criminal film, in the comics he's settled down. He's got himself a wife. He's a bit less violent towards women. So in this film, we see him also settled down. He's got this woman who's his partner, in business partner, criminal partner, sexual partner, presumably. But by the end of the first,
I would assume so. Yeah.
By the end of the first act, he realizes that she's going to kill him to go and get the pieces of map for herself. So he kills her first by electrocuting her in the bath, and then runs off as a single man to go and find Helga Lange and the other pieces of map.
You just made it sound as if he were running toward Helga Lange when it's by chance that he runs across her. But you know, if one had the opportunity to run toward Helga Lange, I'm assuming that you would.
I mean, how did you think the second film compared with the first one?
I'll be honest, I kind of enjoyed the second film a little more than the first. And that may be, you know, that may strike some people as sacrilegious or ridiculous or just plain obvious madness on my part. But I really kind of did, because there's so many things going on.
Yeah.
The whole attempt at a wedding for Inspector Milton, that whole sequence I found incredibly entertaining. And how it ties into, you know, one of the Buddhas, which, you know, once again, super coincidental. And
yes.
Then, but this whole, you know, Buddha statue plotline is built on ridiculous coincidence after ridiculous coincidence. So, okay, fine, let's roll with it, especially when it's going to be this fast and kind of entertaining as hell. And so this movie works for me a little better than the first one.
Yeah, because I think it's got a stronger plot, definitely.
I think so. It feels like there's a better through line for the film, and I enjoyed watching this ride. And it's like, you know, I could have seen myself in a different universe thinking that, you know, if I had seen this movie before I had seen the first film, I might see the first film in an even lesser light than I do. I like the first film. I do. I get a lot of fun out of it, but I do kind of enjoy the second one more. The only place that I think I prefer, well, there are a couple of places I prefer the first film. First of all, two Helga Linnaeus is always better than one. So, you know,
true
point for the first film. And also, I really like the score of the first film more than I do the second. I do really enjoy the score for the first film a lot. It's by a composer who apparently did not do a lot of film work at all. Only a few movies did he score. He was a jazz musician. His name was Romano Mussolini. And I do wonder about that last name, if that was yes. what kind of burden that was to bear. But he was an Italian jazz pianist, and he even ended up being a film producer. But he only did scores for a handful of movies, and this is one of them. And as soon as I saw his name and realized that I didn't know much about him, I thought I would seek out more of his movie work and realize that most of his work was just in just for different jazz albums, different things for different. Albums over the source of his over the length of his career, including all the way up into the 2000s. He didn't pass away until 2006 and was apparently still working on things at the time. But yeah, I do love the score of the first film. But if I had to decide to rewatch one of these movies, I might end up going with the second one on a second viewing, just because I think it's a little bit more fun. It holds my interest more. It doesn't feel so episodic.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. Well, he was actually, Benito Mussolini was his dad. So.
Yeah, yeah, and like I say, there's a little something to that. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Apparently, he did write a book about it, called Il Duce Mio Padre, The Leader My Father, which sounds. Could be interesting, yeah. When he was married to Sophia Loren's sister, so yeah, that's wow. an interesting guy yeah. to learn more about, I'm sure.
I do love his score for the first Criminal film, so yeah,
fair enough. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it is. It's if they're both fun films and they do blend quite well together. Like they follow one follows after the other pretty well, mm-hmm. but.
And they don't feel like a massive tonal or stylistic shift from one to the other either. They do feel like two peas in a pod. They do feel like one film is a sequel to the other. It's very it's very straightforward. There's not a massive change in the way the films feel.
Yeah. Well, that's good. There's a great start to the season. A double bill there of Criminal films.
I had one last thing I'd almost forgotten about. And this may be down to we've already talked about the fact that the only way to really see these movies is to watch subtitled versions. There's no English dub, so I'm not so sure what let's put it this way. I'm not so sure how much we can rely on the subtitles that we have, because I fear that some of these subtitles may have been done by
they're not great.
By fans. I don't think they're necessarily professional.
No, they're not.
But at the very beginning of the first film, when Inspector Milton and a couple of other policemen are waiting for the execution to take place of our main character. One of the police officers there, and he's not seen in the rest of the film, is a French police officer who they refer to as Maigret. M-A-I-G-R-E-S. Now, that is not M-A-I-G-E-T, which would make me think that they were referencing in some sly fashion that very famous French detective. But it's a possibility, and I've not seen anybody mention that before, and I just kind of was curious as to whether or not the subtitles we have. I mean, you can listen to the soundtrack, that it does seem to be the name that's being spoken in Italian.
Right.
So I do wonder if that's something that's kind of flown under the radar for other people.
Mm, that would make sense. They are. They're fun. They're fun movies, and it's always interesting to see somebody like Umberto Lenzi, to see what somebody like him was doing. Before mm-hmm. he became the Umberto Lenzi of the late 60s with the Gialli, and then into the 70s, and then getting to the cannibal films and stuff. I mean, I think by the time he'd done Criminal, he'd done about 20 films. So he was already a very experienced filmmaker by this point, before he was the Umberto Lenzi that everybody knows. Although, by all accounts, he was already at this point quite difficult to work with. just yesterday, I was reading through some of the introductory paragraphs of Troy Howarth's book, and basically the gist of it is Umberto Lenzi was not a great guy, like, was not a very easy person to know or be around. And I read a quote here in Roberto Curti's book. He quotes Glenn Saxon, who says, working with Lenzi was easy, although I was warned in advance that he could be a bit hysterical. So, you know, that's even before he was the sort of famous director that he became. So, yeah.
I have heard similar things from different people, and it's not that much of a shock. Apparently, he could be the word I would use would be prickly. He could be someone. basically, I've heard similar words used to describe what it was like at times working with Lucio Fulci.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But still, like I said, it's always interesting to see what these kind of directors were doing before they really hit the things that would make them the sort of trademark names that they became. So, yeah, so that's Criminal. Next episode, when we finally manage to get to it, we'll be checking out Super Argo, which is basically a Mexican masked wrestler. Mm-hmm. So those are sort of, we're going from a villain to a hero with the next one. Before we finish up, I just wanted to mention a couple of bits of feedback, well, messages that we've had. Some of these ones that I should have covered in the last episode we did before Christmas, but I forgot. So apologies. We did an episode where we talked a lot about Femi Benussi. If you remember Femi Benussi,
mm-hmm.
We talked about her and how she was one of the Jungle Girls, and how we didn't really know much about her. We couldn't find much on her. So Al got in touch. Thank you, Al. He said, Rod and his podcast led me to this one, and I love your discussions about Italian genre cinema. So thanks, Rod, for the marketing there.
We do what we can.
On the last episode, you discussed Femi Benussi and not being able to find much information about her. So he mentions an article that he found that he had to run through translation to get it, but anyway, he sent me the article and it was really good, and I tweeted it out. And I also then, by looking at some of the things in that article, I found another one that covers similar things. So she did an interview in 1977, which was in Italian, but is quoted on the Westerns all'Italiana blog. So I did tweet that out as well, but well worth looking at, because she actually does talk a bit about how she feels about her career. So that was in 1977. She also apparently did an interview. She came out of retirement to do an interview in 2001 for a magazine called Cine 70, but I cannot find that magazine. I can't find a copy of it on eBay. I can't find anything online other than a reference to the fact that she did one. So it appears that she did talk about her career a little bit. So if you're wanting to find out more about Femi Benussi, check out the Westerns all'Italiana blog, or look at our Twitter and you'll see that I did tweet that out. So thanks, Al, for pointing us in that direction. We also had an email from Kurt, who contacted us about the Jungle Queens, and he said, I'm so glad you covered Samoa Queen of the Jungle. I think we're all glad that we covered that. Particularly glad you pointed out it was written by one of the guys who later wrote Cannibal Holocaust, which I didn't know. To my mind, this explains a lot about it, and I wonder what you think. Does it preview any of the themes in Cannibal Holocaust? I'd already been wondering about the second Gungala movie directed by Ruggero Deodato. In the original Gungala film, the blonde protagonist was a straight arrow with a much more heroic moustache. By the end of the second movie, he turned into a diamond-grabbing jerk who needed to be punched. That is true. These Jungle Girl movies were made in 1968, a banner year for anti-establishment messages. In the original Gungala, The hero may have been a straight arrow, but he was surveying for uranium in the service of those who wanted to dig resources out from under the resident's feet. When Deodato directed the second Gungala movie, could he have been slipping in a comment about exploiters of indigenous people? I might be reading too much into this, but I wonder. I'll probably never make myself watch Cannibal Holocaust, but I understand it's heavy on the theme of exploiting indigenous people. The book Darkness in El Dorado wouldn't be published for two more decades, with its claim that Amazon researchers incited violence among the Yanomami. Yanomami people. But I wonder if this stuff was in the air in 1968 and 1980. Well, yeah, I mean, probably. I think that's the sort of the, because the Italian, there was Italian colonization around the Amazon and that kind of things. And so that would have been in the, I would imagine, in the sort of...
Well, Italian, Portuguese, Spanish.
American. Yeah, well, exactly. So I imagine that's the kind of thing that they would have been aware of and talking about, and certainly, yeah, anti-establishment messages would have come through, I would think. I mean, as for Cannibal Holocaust, you and I have talked about this before. I think the first time I ever appeared on the Bloody Pit was to talk about Cannibal Holocaust. Yes. And I know, I understand why people don't want to watch it, but I think it's a masterpiece.
I think we can both sympathize with people who are unwilling to watch it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is a masterpiece.
It's an astonishing piece of work. It is. Yeah. It's amazing, yeah.
It's heads and shoulders above the other film. It's like, it's not, almost not fair lumping it in with the other sort of Italian cannibal films, which generally are leaning far more heavily on exploitation.
Yeah, and there's a lot less on the minds of most of those films than there is. And he's right to point out that Cannibal Holocaust, or to talk about the perception of Cannibal Holocaust being anti-colonialism and anti-exploitation of native cultures, which is very true. That is the main thrust of everything that film presents. There are no, I mean, the closest to a good character in that film is the person who's discovering the footage and just being disgusted by it, you know?
Yeah, who turns out to be a porn star, which is a good twist.
Yes, that yes.
The guy who could take the moral high ground is a porn actor. To be fair to Umberto Lenzi, the man from Deep River is also quite good at sort of presenting an anti-colonial message.
Yeah,
and I do like that film very much. Less so, I mean, Eaten Alive and Cannibal Ferox.
Those are just exploitation films.
Far
more
just
clear.
Exploitation films.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, you know, I've got a soft spot for Eaten Alive. Maybe it's because it was Mimi Leigh. I don't know.
Might have
something to do with it.
It may have something to do with it, yes, sir.
Speaking of which, did you know, I didn't know this until quite recently, Mimi Leigh, she was British, and she left acting and joined the police. She was in the British police.
Wow.
And at least on one occasion, she was in a police squad that raided a video shop that had video nasties available, which during the whole video nasty thing.
Oh my.
She was with the police raiding and taking away copies of films that she was in.
That's amazing.
Pretty funny. She talked about that in an interview, which is quite funny. Anyway, sorry. Yes, so back to cut. Samoa seems a much clearer case of an exploitation movie being about the perils of treating exploiters as heroes. Yeah. Now I'm wondering about writer Gianfranco Clerici's other movies. Yeah, very true. Finally, he says, you got me wondering about the passivity of most jungle girls in the movies they headlined. If these movies had been hits, were the filmmakers leaving room for Tarzan to appear in any sequels? There seemed to be a clear division of labour between jungle girls and jungle guys, with the girls being at one with nature while the guys stabbed crocodiles. Yeah, that's very true. Instead of making the girls the action-oriented protagonists, was the field being left open for the addition of jungle hunks? We may never know.
Yeah.
But Kitty Swan did appear in those Tarzan or Zan movies after playing Gungala. And then he closes, thanks for all you do. Be well and keep watching the vines. Well, yes.
Possibly that's an interesting way of thinking about it. It's always, to me, just appeared to be the typical male gaze and the kind of masculine view of the fairer sex as being, easy, being the gender that would get more in sync with nature, as opposed to the brawny, white hunter type who would just muscle his way through cutting a path through the jungle to get to what he wants. But that's an interesting idea that maybe there, if the genre, the jungle girl genre hadn't flamed out quite so hard in, 18 months, if maybe there hadn't been, if there'd been more and more of them produced, then maybe there would have been a crossover where you had the more nature-oriented female character kind of butting heads with or teaming up in some strange capacity with a more Tarzan-like character. That could have been interesting.
Yeah. There was a resurgence, wasn't there, in the 80s of the sort of Jungle Girl movie?
There were a few that were produced in the 80s, yeah.
Am I misremembering this, or did Farrah Fawcett do one?
Oh, not to my knowledge, no. There was Sheena. They did that 1984 film of Sheena with... oh my goodness, why am I blanking on her name? Because I actually do really have a lot of time for that particular film.
Oh, it's Tanya Roberts.
Right, and it's actually one film that she was ever in that I was kind of impressed with her effort. She's very good in it. I mean,
that's what I was thinking of. Is she more of an action type in that one?
Yes, she gets to do a bit more action. There's a fair amount of action going on in that film, and she's kind of at the center of it. There's a lot of let's put it this way. I avoided the 1984 Sheena, Queen of the Jungle film for a very long time. I think I caught parts of it occasionally on cable in the late 80s and just ignored it because I had, I had my snobbish nose in the air at the time, being a younger man and a much more foolish one. And then years later, in the 2000s, when I decided, it's time to go back and watch that, I had read some of the Sheena pulp stories that the film was based on. And wanted to really kind of take a look. And I was stunned by how much I enjoyed the film and how close it was to adapting a couple of those pulp stories from the 50s. It shocked me. And I really enjoyed the movie. And so I did a complete 180 on it and just was standing there staring at myself in the mirror and going, my God, I'm a fan of Sheena. So I like this movie.
Yeah, that's the one. For some reason, I was thinking... Farrah Fawcett was in that, but it was somebody else with blonde hair.
You may have dreamed something that you wished existed, and now that you've mentioned it, I also wish that it existed.
But yeah, so she gets to be a bit more action oriented than the 60s girls, Jungle Girls, which is it is interesting that maybe they could have done if they'd have made more of those movies. You can see them teaming up with jungle guys, and then having jungle children and. all of that sort of stuff, but
kind of an expansion of the Tarzan family from the Weissmuller film series in the 30s and 40s. Yeah,
that's it. Anyway, thanks, Kurt. And if you want to get in touch with us, there are various ways you can do that. You can, the easiest thing to do is email us, which is just worldworldpodcast@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter @theworldworldpod. We're also on Instagram. And or you could leave us a comment on whichever podcast provider of choice. Leave us a review, or whatever. I don't know. I'm sure there are other ways.
There must be.
Tie a message to a pigeon and send it off in the hope that it finds one of us. I don't know.
That would be fairly impossible, but take a shot. Who knows?
So anyway, that's it for today. Thanks everybody for listening. Welcome back to a new season and to another year, hopefully, of podcasting about the films that the world should not have forgotten.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it. I like that. Quite a tagline.
Yeah, it's a bit clunky, but I'll work on it. I'll see if I can develop
We'll workshop it. Yeah, that's good.
That's good. Right. So yes, join us next time for Super Argo versus Diabolicus, and maybe Super Argo and the Faceless Giants if we can be bothered, but we'll see.
I love the way you put it. Maybe. Yeah, if we can think about it.
Yeah, we're busy guys. Let's not
forget on our plate currently. Yes.
We came up with the plan for this podcast during lockdown when it seemed like we had all the time in the world. I miss those days in many ways.
There are things about it that I miss as well, my friend. Yeah. Yes.
We podcast when we can podcast, and that's the best we can do. And on that positive note, I will say thank you for listening. Come back again soon. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.